Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man I've had the privilege of serving with and admiring greatly in the course of many years of that war is our first guest. He is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under George W. Bush, Douglas J. Feith. He is the author, among other things, of War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. He is today a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, where he directs its Center for National Security Strategies. He's also an old friend. Great to have you with us, Doug. Welcome back.
Great to be with you.
I'd like to start, I think, with Iran. Doug, we're going to be talking with several guests about it in the course of the program today. It seems as though there are still more concessions being made by the Obama administration to the Iranian regime, making this deal less and less like what President Obama initially promised, and certainly less and less like what, during your watch, the UN and, of course, the United States as well was thinking was necessary in terms of a deal with Iran that would prevent it from getting a bomb and be in our interests. Talk a little bit about the deal as it's shaping up as you see it.
Well, I think the important thing to recognize about the deal was that President Obama began his negotiations with Iran by asserting that an Iranian nuclear weapon was unacceptable to the United States. And he said that it was so unacceptable that all options were on the table, which meant that he was implying that he would be willing to use military force to stop the Iranians from getting a nuclear weapon. It's pretty clear from the negotiations now that he has changed his mind on that, that he no longer considers an Iranian nuclear weapon unacceptable. And his current position seems to be that we will accept an Iranian nuclear weapon if we can get some kind of deal that pushes the acquisition of that weapon a little bit down the road. And so he basically has collapsed on the single most important thing, which is the purpose of the diplomacy. And right now, the purpose of the diplomacy, unlike earlier, is not to prevent the Iranians from getting a weapon. The purpose of the diplomacy is basically to kick the issue a little bit down the road. And it's really a collapse.
Yeah, a collapse indeed. It is made the more frightening, it seems to me, even beyond what you've said, which really is we're legitimating this nuclear weapon program, not stopping it. I think it's likely when the president makes his pitch for the deal, as he has to this point, even as the collapsing is taking place, that he will continue to insist that this is blocking it. Given what you know about the enrichment capacity of the advanced centrifuges, the plutonium program, the lack of inspections, the failure to come to grips with previous military dimensions of this program, is it in fact going to be a fraud if he nonetheless claims that this is preventing the Iranian acquisition of a bomb?
It is not preventing it. And if he does claim that, it's not truthful. And I'm really amazed that the administration has collapsed on so many issues as completely as it has. The essence of this deal is it's going to allow the Iranians to get out from under economic sanctions without giving up on their nuclear weapons, without changing any of their behavior, support for terrorism, calls for the destruction of the United States, calls for the destruction of Israel, support for Hezbollah, support for Hamas. And so what you really have is the Iranians are getting a complete get out of jail free card, and they're not even being asked to pay anything significant for it. You would think they should be willing to pay something significant for the lifting of the sanctions, which represents the potential of tens of billions of dollars for them, and they need the money. But what's fascinating is the Iranians obviously have the number of Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama, and they've acted in open defiance and really astonishing contempt for both our Secretary of State and our President. And yet the Obama administration is intent on making a deal with them anyway.
Yeah, it goes beyond whether they should feel that they need to make any kinds of concessions. It's not clear to me they're even being asked to. Doug Feith is our guest now with the Hudson Institute, where he is a senior fellow and director of their Center for National Security Strategies, formerly the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Doug, let me switch gears to one of Iran's neighbors, a country that you have worked a lot with over many years, both in government and out, the nation of Turkey. It has recently had an election that one of our guests coming up, Ilhan Berman, has called an earthquake. Talk about what has happened in Turkey and where you think it's likely to go from here.
The election in Turkey was was the most significant event in politics there for a dozen years or so since the AK party of now President Erdogan came into power in 2002. Erdogan was looking to get a substantial majority in the parliament so that he could revise the constitution and create major new powers for himself in the role of president. And he failed. And this is the first electoral defeat that his party has suffered since 2002. And it's a major repudiation of him. He has built himself up in a very anti-democratic, authoritarian fashion, and wants to and has been changing Turkey's basic outlook on the world from the traditional Republic of Turkey view that it wanted to be a liberal Western democracy to the new view of Erdogan that it should be an Islamist country focusing on the Muslim world and seeking leadership within the Muslim world. It's a major reorientation of the country. And now he suffered a major setback.
With profound implications, among other things, for NATO, right?
Well, he's gone out of his way to break with the United States and with NATO on a number of issues. He's bought Chinese military equipment. He sided with the Iranians on UN matters, where the United States was trying to get pressure on Iran at the UN, and the Turks were on Iran's side. He's taken a strong position against Israel and reversed years of building a strong relationship between Israel and Turkey that his predecessors had worked on. He's reversed that and made Turkey one of the most anti-Israel countries in the world.
Yeah, very problematic on a whole host of fronts, Doug Feith. So quickly, where do you think things are likely to go from here? Will we see a sort of reorientation away from these kinds of very problematic policies towards a more traditional role for Turkey and domestically as well?
That's hard to say. I mean, right now, Turkey is in political turmoil. They still have negotiations underway on what kind of coalition is going to come in to the parliament. If nobody can form a government, there may be new elections soon. So I think it's a little early to say what's going to happen. What we can say is that the rather steady progress that Erdogan made in transforming the country has now been disrupted. And that's the most we could say at the moment. I think it's a very positive development that it has been disrupted, but it's not absolutely clear that it's going to be that it's going to be a change of course.
We will be following it closely, as I know will you, at the Hudson Institute. Douglas J. Feith, one of its senior fellows and director of the Center for National Security Strategies. Doug, thank you for your past service to our country in government, as well as that you've rendered, among other places, to the Center for Security Policy. We're deeply appreciative. Keep it up, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, Dr. Matthew Kronig joins us. We'll talk with him about whether this is the time to strike Iran, and whether we can. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states. One that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are going to continue our conversation about Iran and the negotiations President Obama has underway with the Islamic Republic of Iran with a man who has distinguished himself both in government service as well as in the professoriate. He is Dr. Matthew Kronig, an associate professor at my alma mater, Georgetown University, also a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He is the author of an extraordinarily important and, needless to say, timely book. It's entitled A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. Matt Kronig, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you. And we're sort of on a roll here in terms of trying to get our heads around what it is the Obama administration is up to with respect to Iran. Our first guest, Doug Feith, was saying that, in his estimation, the president has really abandoned his initial stated purpose of keeping Iran from getting a bomb. Is that how you see things with this negotiation now?
That's how I see things as well. I don't think that's how the administration sees things. But, for 70 years or so, the U.S. has had a pretty strict policy of opposing the spread of uranium enrichment and plutonium reprocessing to any country, even our own allies. And now what we're doing with Iran is haggling over the size and scope of an enrichment program. So once Iran has the ability to enrich uranium, it has the ability to make nuclear weapons. So I think what this deal will do will essentially help Iran transition into the nuclear club.
And be legitimated in doing so, I guess, is kind of the real essence here, is that it's not just that we're not stopping them, but we're in a way kind of saying it's all okay, if only we postpone for some period of time, and it's a little unclear how long that will be. But if we can just kick the can down the road a little bit, we'll have, a good outcome. We're visiting with Dr. Matthew Kronig, one of the most thoughtful observers and monitors of what's going on with respect to the Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear weapons ambitions. He is the author of a very important book, A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. Matt Kronig, we're discussing, a work in progress, I guess it's fair to say. And as you've indicated, the administration won't necessarily agree with our characterizations of this. But I think there's very little doubt in the minds of the Israelis, the Saudis, others in the Gulf Cooperation Council, and perhaps others beyond, that Iran is going to get the bomb as a result of all of this negotiating. What are the implications in the region, as you see it, of that perception taking hold?
Well, I think even if before Iran gets the bomb, if we strike this deal that allows Iran to keep uranium enrichment, I think the broader nonproliferation regime will be greatly weakened. The United States has always opposed the spread of these sensitive fuel-making capabilities to all countries. But it'll be very difficult in the future to tell other countries that they can't have uranium enrichment or plutonium reprocessing if we've already made this deal with Iran. And it has the international stamp of international community stamp of approval, as you pointed out. So the South Koreans, for example, have been interested in reprocessing plutonium for a long time. It's going to be very difficult to go to Seoul and say we trust Tehran with uranium enrichment, but not you. So I think this could lead to many other countries demanding similar rights. Other countries in the Middle East have already said, the Saudis have already said that they'll want the exact same capabilities that Iran is given in this deal. So I think we could see a kind of cascade first of the spread of uranium enrichment and plutonium reprocessing technologies. And once that's happened, it's not a very large step to nuclear weapons. So I'm very concerned about the proliferation implications of this deal.
Well, rightly so. Matt, you say it will be very difficult. I think that's charitable. It'll be impossible as a practical matter to say, particularly to our friends and allies, you can't have capabilities we're allowing an enemy nation, which is, let's face it, what Iran is, to have. I'm struck by this. In a way, the best case, Matt Kronig, and you're a serious national security guy and nonproliferation expert, the best case is that people decide they want to follow precisely the approach that the Iranians have taken, because that's a many, many year-long process to put in place all of these centrifuges and laboratories and the like. The other option, which it seems must increasingly be attractive to, let's say, the Saudis, for example, is just to go buy nuclear weapons. The Pakistanis have been long expected to be a supplier to the Saudis. Maybe the North Koreans would. What do you make of the possibilities that the process of cascading non-proliferation unraveling will be accelerated in that fashion, Matt Cronick?
Well, this is something we certainly have to worry about, and I don't know if you know, but actually my PhD dissertation and first book is called Exporting the Bomb, Technology Transfer and the Spread of Nuclear Weapons. So I've given a little thought to this issue of technology transfer. So what's interesting is that throughout the nuclear era, as far as we know, no country has handed over complete nuclear weapons to another country. So it's possible it could happen in this case, especially with Saudi and Pakistan, as you point out. I think much more likely is the transfer of sensitive nuclear technologies that Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, some of these other countries will get help with enrichment, help with reprocessing. And so that would allow them to really jump start a program, and I think do it much faster than the 30 years or so it took Iran to do it.
Well, that may be. We'll be watching it closely. Matt, the substance of your latest book is that this threat is of such grave import that really there is no practical alternative under the circumstances but to use military action to strike Iran and try to take it down, or at least delay what they're working to acquire in the way of nuclear capabilities. How do you see both that need today and the possibilities of actually exercising that option under these circumstances?
Well, the first thing I would say is I don't think we would need to take an immediate military strike. I think if we had a better diplomatic strategy where we continued to keep the economic pressure on, made it very clear about what our red lines for military action would be, and insisted on zero enrichment in negotiation, that we could return to a tougher diplomatic path. And then if that failed, at the end of the line, have a military option as the last resort. So that's what I would advocate for. I think it's very hard to see us returning to that path now under this administration. But as you know, almost all of the major Republican presidential candidates have said that they would walk away from this deal. So I think there is some hope of getting a better Iran strategy in 18 months. Although after this deal struck, it's going to be very hard for the next president to unwind it. But I don't think it's impossible. So I think there is some hope for getting to a better strategy, but we're definitely on the wrong track now.
And Matt, based on what you know, and I know this is a bit through a glass darkly, but based on what you know, do you think that the Iranians will have the capacity to exercise the nuclear option the president seems content to have them retain within that 18 months?
Will they build nuclear weapons in the next 18 months? Will it be too late? I think the real red line for military action is once Iran gets one bomb's worth of weapons-grade enriched uranium. Because once they have the material, it's very hard to stop them.
Do you think we will know when they've reached that? They've got a lot of the stuff around, and it's almost enriched to that level. And who knows what's been squirreled away in secret nuclear facilities.
Right. Well, I'm a little more optimistic on you than this one, I guess, because I think we do know what's been produced in the two declared facilities because of the IAEA inspections. And it's always possible, of course, that they have secret facilities, but for a variety of reasons, I'm doubtful that they have facilities that are already up and running, already enriching uranium.
Well, let's hope you're right, because we're betting the farm on it. Matt Cronick, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I do hope you'll let us come back to you again soon. This is obviously an unfolding story, and you're one of the keenest observers of it. We look forward to a chat about it further with you. Next up, though, we're going to take stock with yet another of our duty experts on Iran, Dr. Ilan Berman. That more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
President Obama's outrageously unconstitutional behavior just keeps accumulating. The latest example is a rumored intention to use his pen and phone to circumvent bipartisan congressional opposition to his radical climate change agenda. Reportedly, the president will assert that he could enter into what amounts to a new treaty on the subject by claiming to be simply amending a very different old one. This gambit would make a mockery of the U.S. Senate's co-equal role in treaty making. The president evidently believes that he can get away with such an affront to the Constitution, as he has so many others, and oblige the United States to reduce its use of carbon-emitting coal. But will endangered coal state Democrats, let alone energy security-minded Republicans, let him perpetrate such a travesty? This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
On June 22nd, the Center for Security Policy will honor Representative Trent Franks of Arizona's 8th Congressional District and the mayor of Irving, Texas, Beth Van Dyne, at its annual Freedom Flame Award Dinner. The evening will take place at the exclusive Metropolitan Club of New York City. For tickets and more information, visit www.securefreedom.org.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word: answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. At the G7 summit in Germany this week, President Obama said this about his strategy to take on ISIS in Iraq.
When a finalized plan is presented to me by the Pentagon, then I will share it with the American people. It's not, we don't yet have a complete strategy.
How can President Obama in June 2015 still not have a plan to deal with ISIS in Iraq? After all, he also said this in August 2014. The truth is the president does have a strategy to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. It's to put significant restrictions on U.S. troops and to do as little as possible so he can say he's a president who got the United States out of wars, not into one. Ultimately, the president wants to hand this mess to the next president. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Ilan Berman, the vice president at the American Foreign Policy Council, a massively influential and consequential contributor to the public policy debate about a whole host of national security issues, notably, but not exclusively, those we'll be talking with him about today, starting off with Iran. He is the author of numerous books, including most recently one about what Iran is up to in the Western Hemisphere, entitled Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America. It is always a pleasure to have him. Welcome back, Ilan. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be back.
Well, speaking of Iran, I've had a chance to visit in the previous segments with our friends Doug Feith and Matthew Kronig about their take on what Obama is up to. They both agreed, and I wonder whether you would as well, that President Obama seems no longer to really be pursuing a bar to an Iranian nuclear weapon, that now it's just a question of kind of managing it and postponing, hopefully, the day when it arises. Is that your judgment as well?
No, sadly, I think that's absolutely right. The ship on rolling back Iran's nuclear program, as far as the White House is concerned, seems to have sailed a long time ago. Every measure that you see either being discussed publicly by the White House or being floated in the international press as part of the emerging and likely nuclear deal that we're going to see in the next couple of weeks
is a lot about trying to slow down Iran's progress, not to roll it back, not to reverse it, not to make Iran, sort of restore Iran to a pre-nuclear state. This is all about trying as best as we can to manage a nuclear threshold state now.
And yet we, I think, are still hearing the president and his spokespeople talking about this being about preventing Iran from getting the bomb. So I asked Doug about this. In your judgment, Ilan, does this really constitute a kind of national security fraud, if that's what they're going to say about this deal?
Well, at the very least, national security delusion, because the way I see it, the only way this deal makes sense in a strategic sense and really even in a tactical sense is it's a 10-year deal. It's not doesn't extend into perpetuity. And in order for Iran not to be a nuclear threat just later, the decade that we have bought ourselves, if this deal is successful, will include a fundamental reorientation of Iran's relations with the West. So despite what the White House says, right, the White House talks a lot about the deal being transactional, it's just on the nuclear issue, but really the only way this deal makes sense is if the tiger really changes its stripes, and I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I don't either. But again, delusions may be a charitable way to describe this, but I do hope that as it emerges, and it's anybody's guess, I guess, Ilan, whether it will emerge, in fact, anytime soon, but it seems as though it's increasingly unlikely it will be by the end of the month. Whether the administration really does try to pull the wool over Americans' eyes and those of the Congress most especially is going to make our jobs interesting and yours in particular important. Let me turn to something else you've been working on and writing about, Ilan Berman, notably at Forbes.com, where you have a very important column, namely the earthquake, as you put it, in Turkey. I had a chance to talk a little bit about this with Doug Feith, but what do you make of the prospects that we'll see a real course correction on the part of the Turks now that they have checked, it appears, Erdogan's ambitions to move further in the direction of a kind of Islamic republic aligned with hostile powers to us, at least?
Right. Well, so the tactical view on what happened in the Turkish elections on the 7th is that it's decidedly a good development. But I think we have to be very careful when we read into long-term trends from this election. What you saw were a few really important takeaways. The first was that the AKP, Erdogan's political party, Islamist political party, suffered a stunning setback. Not only did they not reach the threshold that they were going for, which is to have enough seats, I believe it's 363 in the parliament, to unilaterally be able to change the constitution of the country, they didn't even reach the 200 and some odd seats that they need in order to rule a government. They now need to not have single party rule, they need to have coalition rule. But in that mix, that's obviously important, and one would assume that Erdogan will now have to compromise. But Turkey's other political parties, opposition political parties, are nothing if not fractious and feckless. And it's very likely that what you're going to see is Erdogan make a strategic decision that he can have a minority government, which will compel, I mean, it's his prerogative to do so. He's the president. It will compel early elections in Turkey. So unless these other parties compromise with him, at least in part, this forward momentum may actually lead to backsliding. So I think that, you know, some, although tactically positive, I think this is one to watch for sure.
Especially, Ilan Berman, because one of the things that Turkey is doing under the Erdogan regime has been now for some time enabling the rise of the Islamic State in neighboring Syria, among other bad actors there. What do you make of the role Turkey is playing, and is there any prospect that it will get any better if things do manage to be changed a bit in Ankara?
Right. Well, so here I think there's really negative news and a glimmer of hope. The really negative news is that Turkey's hands-off approach to foreign fighters opposed to the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, including jihadist fighters that go to join the Islamic State, is a consistent long-term policy. Turkey really wants Assad out. We may talk about the need for Assad to go. Turkey's actually putting things in place to try to make it so. And part of making it so involves allowing their territory to serve as a free passage for foreign fighters that are joining the Islamic State. To the point where U.S. intelligence estimates now say that there are about 1,000 foreign fighters that join ISIS every month, and 90% of them go through one transit route. They go through Turkey. So politically, if the U.S. government is serious about fighting ISIS, and I think patently we can take a look at and see that, you know, we are practicing deliberate minimalism in fighting ISIS so far. But if we ever get serious, the low-hanging fruit in terms of applying political pressure is going to be on the Turkish government, because they clearly are the squeaky wheel, and they're integral to stopping the flow of foreign fighters to Turkey.
If it's to be done. I love that phrase, deliberate minimalism, Ilhan Berman. It's, I guess, the successor to leading from behind. And both are bringing us grief. Lastly, just a further word on Syria, Ilhan. What do you make of what is happening there now? Is the fall of the Assad regime increasingly in prospect? And if so, who's likely to pick up the pieces?
I think that's really the $64,000 question. Anybody that tells you they know for certain what's going to happen in Syria is deluding both you and themselves, because, as you know very well, the U.S. intelligence community has been forthcoming with the fact that we haven't had a good opportunity to figure out who all the opposition parties are, who, you know, who's up, who's down, who's a legitimate person we can support, who is not. In fact, that's part of the justification for why the Obama administration has taken such a hands-off approach. But the aggregate result here is that what you're looking at is an at least three-sided conflict. You have Syrian opposition forces, not including the Islamic State, but including Islamist elements, who are fighting the Assad regime. The Assad regime is fighting them, and simultaneously it's fighting the Islamic State, which is a different consolidated group. And so in this conflict, it's very hard to figure out who's up, who's down, and how to pick winners and losers. But if our fear is that a fall of Bashar al-Assad is going to lead to Syria becoming part of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's caliphate, which I think is a very legitimate fear, then it can't escape our attention that by providing aid to opposition forces that are fighting Assad, we're making him less effective in fighting the Islamic State.
Among others. It also is, of course, of great interest to the Iranians, and a subject for a further conversation with you, I hope, at a near time. Ilhan Berman, your help in figuring out who's deluding whom and how delusional is our policies is really appreciated, because there's a lot of it going on in official Washington these days. And one of the delusional pieces seems to me to be the idea that we can bring refugees from Syria safely here when the FBI tells us that they cannot vet them. Another example of dangerous delusional behavior. Ilhan, thank you for the work you do at the American Foreign Policy Council and your extraordinary output, and among other places at Forbes.com. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. James O'Keefe joins us next. We'll talk with him about scandalous mistreatment, more of it, taking place at the VA. That more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined once again, I'm very pleased to say, by a man I've come to admire greatly for his, well, daring do on the one hand and his keen sense of what kinds of facts need to be exposed that are generally being concealed from us. He is James O'Keefe, best known for the work he has been doing for some time now as the founder and president of Project Veritas, an undercover organization of investigative journalism that has done extraordinarily important work on things like ACORN and Planned Parenthood and labor unions, National Public Radio, and more. He has
to his credit, a New York Times bestseller entitled Breakthrough, Our Guerrilla War to Expose Fraud and Save Democracy. James is a man of many parts, and he has just turned his exposés on the Veterans Administration. Treatment of our vets is a big issue for us here at Secure Freedom Radio, and we're delighted to have you back, James, to talk a bit about your latest findings. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
So, what did you find when you went undercover in the Veterans Administration, James?
Well, a year ago, we learned that there were all types of problems, mismanagement, bonuses at the VA, and, you know, this has been something that I've been wanting to do for some time. We were able to go to conferences and confabs featuring some of these federal employees. And we weren't really sure what we'd get, but what we found was footage of these high-ranking VA officials all telling us more or less the same thing, that they drug veterans, that they overprescribe medication. And in fact, the lead in our story, McCarthy is her name, she actually said that the overprescription is caused by us. And we drug these people, and it's not right. We also talked to other employees who said that we create drug addicts. We talked to a father who just recently lost his son who committed suicide because they were on medication they didn't need. And it's really a heartbreaking video investigation. It shows that this is a huge problem. The 22 veterans are dying every single day. And there needs to be some reform. They can't continue to give out these drugs to veterans who suffer from PTSD. They don't need the drugs. They need actual clinical treatment of some type. So the video is a remarkable one that it actually shows these federal employees being honest and saying something about what they're doing they wouldn't say under oath.
And this really is the crux of the matter, James. You've gotten a degree of candor that ought to translate into corrective action, if anything can. The VA has proven resistant, shall we say, to this kind of congressional oversight and even exposés by folks like yourself. Is there reason to believe that your findings about, well, turning veterans into drug addicts may actually cause change in the Veterans Administration?
I think over time it will. I think in the very beginning they want to circle the wagons, but there was a subcommittee congressional hearing last week where they brought the videos up and they showed the videos in Congress. And it's a heartbreaking story. You know, we get a lot of tips and a lot of people sending us information. You need to look into this, you need to look into that. This has been one we have had thousands of emails after this story. Everyone is affected by this because everyone knows a veteran. So there was a congressional hearing. It's a tough thing because it's not just the VA that deals with this problem. I think this is a problem that happens everywhere, is overprescribing opiates to deal with stress or anxiety or in this case, it's post-traumatic stress. So it's not just the VA. The difference is the veterans deserve a special type of treatment because of the sacrifices they've made for their country. And they're a federal government agency, and they deserve to be held to a higher standard than the rest of the country.
Indeed, and I trust that you will keep up the good work on this front, James O'Keefe with Project Veritas, and we support what you're doing and look forward to get your updates. Let me ask you, speaking of updates, James, to turn to two of your other recent exposés that were also riveting and in both cases really quite alarming. Maybe we could start with the imagery of your experiences as you tried to come across the southern border of the United States wearing the mask of bin Laden and a getup comparable to one he would have worn. What were your experiences in that, and what came of the revelations of your experiences?
Well, that supplanted the Acorn story as being the most renowned of our investigations. You know, someone said to me, well, what if you actually just crossed the border between Mexico and the United States and filmed it? Another person said to me, what if you just crossed the border as a terrorist, you know, as a mock terror? Well, I combined the two ideas and I crossed the border dressed like Osama bin Laden. And this was a very narrow stretch of the Rio Grande. People think of the Rio Grande, they think of the Mississippi River. In West Texas, it's actually only about 10 or 12 feet wide. And I just traipsed across the Rio Grande and filmed it, and it caused outrage. And
because nothing happened, right?
Because nothing happened, because there was no federal border security anywhere, because we looked out for miles and couldn't even see any federal agents anywhere. There was a fence, but it went for a few miles and then stopped. and then went for a few miles and then stopped, which begs the question, why would you build a half-hearted fence at all? It doesn't do anything. So people in this country are very politically divided on this issue. And I've actually had some libertarians, people who are friends of mine, get angry at me for doing this because the video was so effective. I mean, the video demonstrated just how porous our borders were and how they're lying to us about. And they get angry and say, why would you do that? Why would you get illegal immigrants? I said, look, this isn't about me being against immigrants or anything. This is about our politicians are lying to us about our borders being secure. That's it. And you can be against, you can be pro-illegal immigration or anti-illegal immigration. It doesn't matter. But our politicians should not lie to us and say, oh, our borders are secure, when I can just walk across just like Osama bin Laden and not get caught.
Well, and particularly the very explicit message is whatever one thinks about illegal immigration, I don't think anybody favors having bin Laden or people like bin Laden or the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or the Muslim Brotherhood or others making that trip. James, let me turn to one other of your extraordinary exploits, and that was your exploring how campus authorities responded when students at two different universities asked whether it would be okay to have a chapter of ISIS or an organization supportive of ISIS, at least, on campus. What did you find there, and what's your latest on that?
Well, we did a story on Barry University in Florida, and there was a young woman, I'll just reveal her first name, Laura, who went undercover into her office where you start an organization, and she said she wanted to start an ISIS club. She used the word ISIS, unlike the Cornell example where we just spelled it out. We said Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Well, in the case of Florida, we repeatedly used the acronym ISIS to these administrators on campus. We want to start an ISIS group and send them aid and supplies, and can we change the name so that people don't know what we're actually doing? And the woman said, yeah, of course, change it to something else. Change it to students in support of the Middle East. Now, that caused an absolute shockwave. This is a Catholic school. I didn't frankly even know it was Catholic. This is a student who was interested in doing this. And the president of this school started crying in a closed-door meeting with an attorney for this undercover reporter that was now being disciplined. Oh, you've ruined my life. You've ruined the school. The donors are taking money away. And, Project Veritas, we expose things. We expose wrongdoing. And we've sort of let the chips fall for they may. But I think people deserve to know what these schools are doing and their behavior. And if they're willing to sanction and provide funding for an ISIS club on campus, that's a fact that people deserve to know. So this student, what happened was, since I last spoke to you, she was not allowed to graduate. They were trying to kick her off campus. We created a petition campaign. We galvanized support on Twitter and on email. And now she is being allowed to graduate, and she graduated with a 4.0 GPA. She did not give her any B's or C's. She was already a 4.0 GPA, but we were thinking they were going to discipline her. So that's good.
It is good. It is good for her. It is good for you, I hope, at Project Veritas, and it's certainly good for the cause of freedom. Again, James O'Keefe, thank you very much for what you do and for sharing the fruits of it with us from time to time. I look forward to talking with you again in the near future. I look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.